Here's a question. Does Florida's famous swing voter really exist? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, how a new political model called negative partisanship could drive the fall elections. We'll speak with political and data scientist Rachel Bitecofer, and we want your calls. We will get your vote this November. Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, COVID cases are on the rise again in Florida as the state expands reopening, and that is worrying public health experts. But first this hour, as Jacksonville prepares for the Republican National Convention to come to town this summer, we've been hearing a lot about the importance of Florida to both parties as the ultimate swing state. But what if everything we think we know about swing voters is wrong? Newer models suggest there really aren't as many of them out there as conventional wisdom would suggest. So what does that mean for us this fall in the 2020 election as we deal with the convention, COVID cases, Black Lives Matter protests, and more? Political scientist Rachel Bitecofer is assistant director of the Wason Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. And she says more than anything this year, negative partisanship is going to drive voters to the polls. She's on the line with more about her model. Dr. Bitecofer, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Are you motivated to vote for a candidate or against one? Who will get your vote fall in November? It's 549-2937 to join us. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So Dr. Bitecofer, you first gained a lot of attention when you very accurately predicted the Democrats' 41-seat victory, the sweep they had in the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2018 midterms. And your data suggests that voters are driven out today on both sides by what you call negative partisanship. How do you define negative partisanship?
So negative partisanship is a term that comes from research into political polarization. I'm applying that term to election and voting behavior, but it refers to the negative emotions that people feel that's grounded in their own partisanship, so being a Democrat, being a Republican, towards the opposition party. So that could be hate. It could be dislike, but sometimes it's fear, right? Fear of what the other party will do when they're in power or what they are doing when they're in power, which is why the party that is out of power usually has a negative partisanship advantage because they are living under a regime that is currently asserting power over them.
And so you see that dynamic then favoring the Democrats in 2020. You believe Democrats will be
Correct.
Even more driven to come out to the polls than Republicans. What would you say, though, to all the Republicans, especially those here in Florida, who are very motivated to come out and reelect President Trump?
Yeah, so Florida is a great case. Florida is an incidence state in which, in terms of voter registration, Democrats have outnumbered Republicans for the last couple of decades. But you might have noticed they haven't been winning statewide elections, right? Mm. And so that's a pretty interesting phenomenon. Some of that is a product of the electioneering differences between the two parties. Republicans, I like to say, play master chess when it comes to electioneering, and Democrats play Connect Four. They're not as good at getting, their existing game pieces out to the polls. So some of that is this. In 2018, what really stood out for me was that I knew in 2016 Democrats had kind of held back their muscle. They had this much larger demographic muscle than they chose to flex, and a lot of that was the perception that Clinton was an inevitable winner and the complacency that came with that. So they figured, she would win anyway. They didn't really need to show up to vote. Many people who did show up to vote voted for third-party candidates. It was much higher third-party voting than what we saw in 2000, which is kind of the election people think about for third-party voting. And they didn't flex that demographic muscle in a big way. And so after that, I knew that since they had kind of got caught sleeping, and the end result of that was a Trump administration, that 2017 in Virginia, where I'm at, which has off-year elections, and then going forward to 2018, 2020, Democrats would behave very differently, though they would flock to the polls in huge numbers. The turnout would spike by a large amount, which is exactly what we've seen since. However, you know, Republicans have behaved very differently than Democrats did when Obama was in power. And when Obama was in power, Democrats really pulled back in terms of participation. They got very comfortable. Republicans have not done that. They had a turnout spike, too, in 2018, and I'm expecting a very strong turnout for them in 2020. Mm. The question is, though, in most cases, they're not the larger voter bloc. So, if you know, can they survive in a situation where there's a large turnout surge for Democrats and left-leaning independents?
We'll go to your calls for political and data scientist Rachel Bidecofer in a moment, 549-2937 to join us. So then, given that the presidential election is expected to come down to a handful of swing states, including Florida, how do you see the election playing out?
Yeah, I love Florida. It's one of the most fascinating states in politics, and I love Florida in ways that, I mean, I think Florida's used to being loved, so certainly anybody who's listening to this program
and made
now
fun of.
True. I mean, you know, but I won't make fun of you, Florida. You know, I think that people who are listening to this program, especially probably what I call like the creme de la creme of citizens, so they're highly engaged, informed, and intellectually curious, civically minded people. So you're on the, you know, the outside curves of the bell curve, and you're my kind of people. So that means that you're paying attention to politics, and you'll know then that Florida plays a special role and that, you know, a lot of analysts are obsessed with you, but I'm obsessed with you in a different way. And the way that I'm obsessed with you of many different ways, but one of the ways is the high turnout rates that you guys enjoy due to absentee ballot voting, particularly on the Republican side. So it's kind of interesting that absentee balloting has become this topic of hot topic. Mm-hmm. In 2020, of course, that's a product of the pandemic and people's fear of in-person voting. Obviously, with a pandemic, you don't want to expose yourself to a virus. So people have been looking at absentee balloting as an alternative. But in Florida, the Republican Party kind of innovated. I mean, this is where absentee balloting was innovated by the Florida GOP. And it's been actually a big part of the reason Florida Republicans have won all these statewide elections with less numbers in registration. And so I must imagine that they are sitting there every time the president talks about coming after absentee balloting or you know, kind of just giving it a bad name, kind of shaking their heads and going, no, don't do it.
Right. They want absentee balloting as much as the Democrats.
So does Trump, right? Because he needs to carry Florida. And if he wants to do that again, absentee balloting is going to be a critical component of that. So,
do you see the Democrats or the Republicans winning Florida this time?
Well, so my model is very bullish on Florida. It was very bullish on Florida in 2018, too. And my model is as far as these things go, fairly accurate. But in Florida in 2018, I went with my model completely. I trusted it, and I said, okay, my model is very bullish on Florida. The demographics and the surge potential for Democrats is obviously there. They have a huge registration advantage, and it should happen, right? And then it didn't happen, and the reason is because Republicans are turning out at nearly 80% and Democrats are not. And so, and even with that big catalyst of negative partisanship, Democrats increased their turnout, but they did not come anywhere close to parity with Republicans. And again, that's a product of electioneering differences between the parties. So this time around, my model is producing a Florida win for Democrats, but I am handicapping it basically manually to account for that electioneering difference. So I have it listed as one of my very few. I only have three toss-ups right now, and Florida is one of them.
All right. Let's go to some calls now. Who will get your vote this fall, and are you driven by what Dr. Bidecofer calls negative partisanship? 549-2937. Give us a call. MJ on the north side. MJ, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks for calling. So what's motivating you to vote this time?
Well, ever since I was old enough to vote, I've been very motivated to vote. That is our voice. It's supposed to be our voice to get people in there who will represent us. And this particular election year, I am extremely motivated because I would like to vote against a certain candidate.
And who's that?
Well, I'm not a Republican. not this year.
There you go.
Not this year. So in other words, what I hear you saying is you're motivated to vote against President Trump. Is that right?
I am.
Okay.
And I've voted Republican in years past. I want to vote with candidates who align with my ethical and moral values and who I feel will benefit our country the most. That's not Donald Trump.
So it's not you're not casting a vote for Joe Biden so much as you're casting a vote against the president, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
That's unfortunate, but
all right, and thank you for that, MJ. I appreciate the call. So, Dr. Bykofer, this comports with your theory that voters, particularly moderate female voters like MJ, are highly motivated to turn out against President Trump. But you also, in your research, find that Republican voters are equally motivated and enthusiastic to turn out. So this is going to be one for the ages, this election.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it is not a hyperbolic statement to say. I mean, this is something that everyone has always thrown around. And now I haven't been around all that long, so I would have been more cautious in my language, so people have to take my word for it. But in this case, we do know that, you know, America, we are in an interesting spot, right? We just had a pandemic come in. And a huge economic collapse that's related to the pandemic. Now, in the international context, our pandemic has been much more severe because of the way that it was responded to. So when we look internationally, you know, ours is one of the worst in the world, and many, many, many countries navigated this pandemic with very few fatalities compared, right? Mm-hmm. And we look at the world opinion data. Like almost every country that has free and fair public opinion, you see public opinion go up or down for their world leader. Only ours stayed flat. And why that happened is that our body politic is very sick right now. Like polarization is a word your viewers, your listeners are used to hearing. But it's not just a buzzword. It's a tangible, empirical, measurable condition. As a political scientist, it's a condition of the body politic that's having extreme effects. And one of those effects actually is that our democracy has actually been downgraded from a full democracy to a flawed democracy. And one of the reasons is that we are no longer able to govern ourselves effectively, right?
And who did the if I could ask, who did the downgrading?
That's The Economist, which is a fairly conservative, well-respected, international publication that's based in the UK. So, you know, they have a list of indicators: pluralism, voter representation, access, media, you know, policy making, all these different, and you can check that on their website. It's called the Democracy Index on The Economist. And I really mm-hmm. recommend people do because you, when you look at America in the international context, it really becomes clear we're at this precipice, and this election is about very much more than Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is, you know, he is what he is, but he is definitely, you know, he's not a cause. He's a symptom of a system that is, you know, we're at a precipice. and you know, we as a society have to make a decision as to which direction we want to go in terms of, you know, the democratic principles that have gotten us this far. You know, do we want to maintain those or not? But I do think that, you know, people are seeing this election in a heightened atmosphere because of that.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, because of partisanship, though, you know, it becomes bigger than the man. So when you ask a Republican voter on a survey, do you approve of Donald Trump? I think, to be honest with you, you could get into a lot of Republicans' heads. There are times, like with this this photo op that he did during the protest, that they don't approve of that. But they know when they answer that poll question, what they're really answering for, they think, are Republican principles, right? So they're answering for them. They're not talking about him. They're talking about them.
And that's at the heart of your research, which is that our politics are tribal. If you are a Republican, that's your identity. And if you're a Democrat, that's your identity. You're going to come out and support whoever the candidate is at the top of your ticket, even if you have qualms about them and you don't agree with some of their moves in office. It's tribal. Now, let me ask you one more quick question before we go back to callers. We do have President Trump coming to town in August for the Republican National Convention acceptance speech. Our city landed this after North Carolina told the president, we do not want a full arena because we're concerned about the spread of COVID-19. So here in Jacksonville, we've seen the mayor make two moves in quick succession. First, he said he was pulling down all of the Confederate monuments in the area, which have been long a controversy and a source of upset. And then right after that, we learned Jacksonville landed the RNC. And so we are expecting quite a bit of protest here and thousands of people flocking into downtown Jacksonville to attend the speech without masks or social distancing to protect from COVID, most likely. And so as the president comes to town, Duval County is seen as a swing county in a swing state. What are your thoughts about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends, I think, on your perspective. If you're an ardent fan of Donald Trump, you probably see this as a good thing, right? You're excited he's coming to where you are. You don't need to get opportunity, perhaps, to engage in that. Probably if you're not directly benefiting in that way, you're probably not happy in terms of the COVID exposure and the protest issues. I think it's probably just a tough environment to host a convention. And to be frank, you know, the Democrats are not going to do a convention, right? They're not going to be doing an in-person convention. They're going to do something virtually. But if they were doing a convention, you know, the protest type of environment that we're in would, you know, I think any city right now would have hesitation to host a convention in the environments that we're in. So there are negative externalities to getting these conventions. There are certainly economic benefits, and in today's economy, with the economic collapse that we've suffered, is obviously there's some benefits to that as well. But certainly, you know, we're looking at these rates spiking up for COVID, and it's really a circumstance where we've seen a virus. The problem with COVID is a virus in which people see the health benefit or the health risks as falling onto others and not themselves. So I think that's really dictating a lot of behavior.
549-2937. Kelly on the South Side. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Yes, I just got finished commenting that moving from Texas, I was able to vote independent and vote in all of the elections as an independent voter. I come to Florida and I cannot. And when the man who is presently sitting in the White House was voted in, I actually had to choose a party, and it ended up having to be the Democratic Party because I could never go straight Republican. I believe that whoever's in the office should be able to do the best job, regardless of which party it is. But whenever he came into office, I had to choose a party, and because I just can't. So,
okay.
But that's the one thing it would be nice to be able to change here in Florida is how the independent voter is allowed to vote.
Right.
Not just in a big election. A general election would even be nice, but we cannot.
Yeah. Thanks, Kelly, for that. Ooh. I appreciate that. You know, Dr. Bidecofer, we have, I think it's more than 25% of voters in Florida are NPA, no party affiliation. But that means they cannot vote in primaries. This is a closed primary state. So you have a binary choice if you want to participate fully in the process. And as we heard from that voter, she didn't really want to choose a party, but she chose one.
Yes, in order to be able to be fully enfranchised in the process, you do get pushed in those closed primary states into registering in a party that you don't necessarily ascribe to, and that is an unfortunate you know, part of that. And you know, I don't take a position on the type of primary model that's most, you know, advantageous. And Virginia is an, I will say this, that Virginia is an open primary state, And as an independent, I really am grateful that I can decide which party's primary I want to participate in on election day.
Now, you said a few minutes ago you see Florida as going blue this fall, but with some caveats. You, as I pointed out at 9 o'clock when we started, you correctly predicted you were only one seat off the 2018 midterms. You believe that former Vice President Joe Biden will beat Donald Trump in the fall, and that the choice of his vice president is not particularly important, simply based on this negative partisanship model that you've developed. Are you still holding to that?
So, yes. I mean, yes. I mean, ultimately, I argue that Biden had an advantage, and this was before pandemic and economic collapse came in, which has heightened these advantages significantly for him. Due to this fact that, you know, just like in 2018, that, you know, in the Senate map, Democrats only, the wave manifested insofar as that the Senate map was so hostile to them in the states that were up. These were realigning Republican states that were held by Democrats, Indiana, Missouri. Those are states moving towards the Republicans, that they could only do so well. Like, the way the wave manifested was to for them to pick up a couple Senate seats and only lose a couple. In the House, they, of course, had this big wave, right? Because the wave, the House seats were in these suburban districts. We've got suburban areas with high rates of college-educated voters, which is what my, you know, my theory argues, moving towards the Democratic Party, as the Republican Party has embraced populism and basically the MAGA agenda. And, you know, that was a really conducive for this big wave for Democrats in 18. And in 20, it's the same basic function. Now, I do talk about, though, like, risk mitigation for Democrats and various, like, factors that could upset the model. And so I do argue that actually, and I had a New York Times op-ed that came out right as the George Floyd, you know, murder backlash was just beginning to build, that the best way for Biden to mitigate risk of losing is to pull up turnout of Democratic voters and left-leaning independents and moderate independents. And the way to do that actually is not the way that people think about it back in the 80s and the 90s, because the population of America has changed so much. And now we're talking about millennials being 40 years old. People keep thinking about college students as millennials, but that's actually an entirely different generation, Gen Z. So I argue that he should be looking at somebody like Kamala Harris or Stacey Abrams or Val Demings, you know, because the diversity of the country really requires a diverse ticket in the year 2020. You don't want to have two white moderates representing the Democratic Party, which is the most diverse party in history, you know, in the year 2020, especially because Biden kind of maxes out the white moderate, like, appeal of the ticket. I mean, he is, like, the first choice of white moderate, like, crossover appeal. You can't possibly do any more appeal over in that group than Biden himself out of the 25 people that ran for the Democratic nominee. And Trump.
That's right. There were all, like, two dozen people in the beginning.
No doubt.
Yeah.
And Biden was, like, choice number one, right, of, like, that demographic group, right? And what you do run into is in 2016, like, the other analysts put all this attention on white working class voters. Well, the reason Clinton did worse amongst them is that they have been moving non-college educated whites away from the Democratic Party. And it wasn't so much about Clinton as it was about the way that the party realignment has been shaping out for the last couple of decades. But these voters are moving to the Republican Party, and it's happening all across America, not just in certain regions anymore.
Yeah. And let me just jump in and say, lots of tweets, emails, and calls for political scientist Rachel Bitecofer. Jim tweets the show, it's the people who don't vote in most elections who become swing voters when they do show up. Rebecca tweets us and says, when you ask whether I'm voting for someone rather than against, Joe Biden was maybe my fifth or sixth choice in the primary, but I'll campaign for him with everything I have. I believe Trump is dangerous for democracy. Here is an email from Yuri. I'm voting third party since both of the major parties are for big government and crazy spending, he says. And here's one more tweet of the 1.4 million Florida citizens who now have the right to vote again due to Amendment 4. What percentage of them need to actually register and take part in November in order to make a difference? And that gets to the whole voting population of people who've been incarcerated formerly in Florida. Will they be able to cast a ballot or not? That's still being litigated. One more tweet for you from the Jackson Mag. Would Biden picking Val Demings as VP impact the model for Florida, considering she's from Jacksonville and built her career in Orlando? That's Congresswoman Val Demings, former police chief of Orlando. Would that make a difference in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, other than the fact that she's a you know, female of color, the best thing that Val Demings has going for her, I think, is the relationship to the I-4 corridor, right? Which is an area that Democrats just consistently underperform. Again, I mean, there's other ways to fix that problem. And there's ways, you know, just look at what the Florida GOP does and copy that. You don't really need a Florida candidate to perform well in Florida. But it's, you know, if you're struggling in Florida, a good way to do it might be with Val Demings. I think she's definitely a good of the top four candidates that I suggest. Val Demings is definitely on the top four list.
Let's go to Dave on the South Side. Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. Happy Monday.
Hey, thanks so much. So I'm sort of witnessing something that's rather fascinating. I lean extremely libertarian, very much someone who's in favor of government reduction. And the police issue is a no-brainer to me. I don't want more money to go into the police force. If anything, I want to see reforms. I want to see us change from a retributive and punitive criminal justice system to a restorative and redemptive one. And so it's ironic to me because I'm watching so many of my liberal Democrat friends and people of color who are calling for these reforms, and to see the other side, the conservative friends I have, and I'm like, what is going on? I feel like the world has gone crazy because this is a conservative principle. We want to see people's rights not violated. This is a no-brainer. And so I am stuck.
And stuck on who to vote for, you mean?
Oh, my God. I mean, I just cannot. It's not so much, I don't know that I'll vote against someone, but I will vote for someone who is going to change our criminal justice system.
Okay.
Who is going to bring reduction to the atrocities and the violation of people's rights, whatever color they are. You know, this happens across the board. And so I just, that to me is a fascinating thing to be witnessing. Is to
see
all of my liberal friends who are saying, hey, people's rights are being violated. And on the other side, I've got conservative friends who are like, we need more police. And I'm like, you're not a conservative.
Thanks, Dave. That's a fascinating perspective. Rachel Bytko, for these cries to defund the police, how is that going to cut with voters?
Yeah, you know what? This is this is just fascinating as a social scientist, and very few things surprise me, actually, which is why the betting markets really like to follow me. But what does surprise me, if you told me a month ago that Black Lives Matter would be polling in the 60s and not the 40s, I would not have been able to predict that. And I'm really happy to have not caught that and be wrong on it, because it's a movement, you know, that should be polling in the 60s, because the issue of police violence and, you know, just police reform, I mean, it's our law enforcement. Again, I just urge people, whenever you can, look at American and international context. When you do so, then you become aware of the way that we are an outlier in many, many ways. And you also see avenues to reform that are quite obvious. And police reform is really doable. It's a doable thing. We can do good law enforcement and take care of our officers and our police system and our citizens, and also make sure that people's rights aren't being violated. Not that hard to do, because other countries do it all the time. And as this young man is wrestling with this orthodoxy, I do just want to say that, you know, actually, you know, it's really interesting how much ideologies have evolved over the time period. So, like, in the 60s, in the Warren Court, what really sets that court, I mean, he probably thinks of the Warren Court as this great evil thing. But, you know, back in the days when you heard, in terms of the court, when you meant liberal and conservative court, what you actually meant was liberals were looking at individual rights and conservatives on the court were thinking about, like, the rights of the state, right? So I would urge him to go back and look at those two ideological constructs in the court doctrines, and it might make sense to him why so many of his conservative friends are driving him nuts.
It's a fascinating time, to say the least. And I so appreciate your insights. Good to speak with you. She's political scientist Rachel Beitkofer. She's assistant director of the Wason Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University in Virginia. Thank you so much, and talk to you soon, I hope.
Yeah, no, you should have me back. I should say my affiliation is actually no longer at the university. I'm at the Niskanen Center in D.C., and I loved your listeners. Were so great, so I'd be happy to come back and talk to them some more.
Thank you. Duly noted. Thanks for that. And much more still ahead later in the hour.
Actually, moving forward quite nicely, pretty strong, I would say.
Some good news. Real estate going strong in this area, even in the pandemic. But up next, COVID cases spiking in Florida once again. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is David McGowan, CEO here at WJCT, and I'd like to say thank you to all of you who helped us meet our goal during our fundraising drive last week. We are here for you, and you were there for us. Thank you.
The Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share handpicked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Welcome back. Well, today marks World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, a day to raise awareness about how seniors are often targeted for various scams and forms of abuse. In the COVID pandemic, that's become especially true. A free Zoom conference is coming up today at noon where you can learn more. I spoke about it with Nancy Tufts, VP at Elder Source of Northeast Florida. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So today is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, and you want to raise awareness because seniors, particularly in Florida, where we have so many seniors, can be targeted so often for financial, psychological, or even sexual abuse. What's happening today to raise awareness here in our city?
Thank you, Melissa. Today, Elder Source is hosting a virtual World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. It will take place at 12 o'clock. We are partnering with the Florida Department of Health, Nassau County, to host a one-hour Zoom workshop. We'll provide an overview of how seniors are targeted for financial, psychological, and sexual abuse. And we're having experts from Elder Source, Regions Bank, and the Women's Center of Jacksonville present information on scams, legal ways to help elders and their families not become victims of abuse, and then an overview of some of the most popular money and scams on seniors.
And with COVID-19, this is a particularly important topic, isn't it? Seniors are even more vulnerable right now.
This is very true. The COVID-19 crisis has impacted our seniors particularly hard. Stay-at-home orders can leave vulnerable seniors trapped and at the mercy of their abusers. According to the National Center on Elder Abuse, between 700,000 and 3.5 million older adults are abused or neglected in the United States each year. And for every case that's reported, 14 go unreported.
Mm. And so Elder Source is really, in Northeast Florida, one of the leading agencies working with seniors on all of these issues. This Zoom workshop today is for anyone who has a senior in their family or in their world, or anyone can log on to this, and they're going to learn a lot, it sounds like.
They definitely will. And, you know, Melissa, one thing that we find is that older people living with abuse, they may be afraid or embarrassed to talk about it. If we keep our eyes open and we know what to look for, we can help and make sure that our friends and our loved ones stay safe.
So people need to go to your website, myeldersource.org, and they can log on to this free call today at noon. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. So check it out. It's today at noon, as Monday, June 14th is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. VP at Elder Source, Nancy Tufts, on with us. Nancy, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Melissa.
Well, since the Memorial Day reopening, COVID cases in Florida are back on the rise. Sunday, the State Department of Health reported its second consecutive day of more than 2,000 new daily cases. On Saturday, they reported a daily record of 2,581 new COVID cases. Amidst all this, some Florida bars and restaurants are closing down again, like Lynch's Irish Pub at the beach, just after they had reopened because their workers are testing positive for the virus. Chad Nielsen is a specialist with UF Health, JAC's Division of Infectious Disease. He's on the line. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Good to have you back on the show. So we're seeing records of new cases in Florida now in phase two of this reopening, just as bars, movie theaters, more businesses open up. How concerned are you about these spikes?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that we're overall surprised. Those of us in the public health field, feared that phase two reopening could cause another spike in cases. And unfortunately, that's exactly what we're seeing. Memorial Day weekend combined with, the hot weather and everybody's sort of quarantine fatigue has really led to the masses going out. And I think we're on the tip of it. I don't want to say second wave. I don't think we're quite out of the first wave yet. So. Those of us in the field are very concerned.
So you're concerned about not even being done with the first wave and seeing a potentially even bigger wave of disease. Is that what you're projecting?
Yeah, I think right now we're just on the tip of what would be a second wave, right? But, I mean, if you look at all the hospitalization data, it's never really dropped across the state. So it's remained fairly flat, right? We flattened the curve in Florida. But it hasn't seen a big dive yet. So we're still in this maintenance phase. And now with, the phase two reopening and more bars and restaurants and more, big public gatherings occurring, we're primed to have additional cases moving forward unless local cities and county governments are prepared to start enforcing some of the things they did during phase one.
Right. And is that a possibility? How do you think the state should be responding to this? Because on the one hand, they've certainly got to maintain our health. But on the other hand, they're hearing from the business community and simply from voters who are saying they're sick of all of the social distancing, the lockdowns. We're seeing fewer and fewer people out there wearing masks. What do you think the state should do?
Yeah, well, I think the state needs to really put the power back into the business owner's hands and say, look, we want you guys to be able to do business. We want to do this in a safe way. But the businesses really have to enforce some of these social distancing and masking guidelines. I was out myself this weekend here locally at the town center and just driving through to do a order pickup. I was shocked at how many cars and how many stores were packed. And very few of those stores had any kind of, measures on the front end. To hand out masks or provide sanitizers. And so I think it's a double-edged sword. If businesses want to be open, I think those business owners, have to be getting guidance from the state that, hey, if you want to stay open, you got to monitor yourself and you have to do things to ensure that you can make your money and we can allow the public to shop, but in a safe way.
We've seen a few bars and establishments in the last day or two close down again. They're worried about their employees and the public. We passed a milestone over the weekend, 117,000 deaths from COVID. That's more than the total number of Americans killed in World War I. And amidst all this, as the Republican convention comes to town in August, and we're getting it because another state, North Carolina, said, no, we don't want an arena packed full of people spreading the virus. What are your concerns about the RNC?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's been already, talked about in other shows and other you know, media outlets, that there's a high level of concern that anytime you're bringing a large amount of people together, you're especially from out of state and out of the community, you have a high risk. The CDC just updated some of their guidelines on community events and the types of risks associated with each. And, you can read that website and you can tell very clearly where the RNC event is going to fall on that. And so I think that the local community leaders here, the government, the public health department are all already making contact with the RNC to put some measures in place, hopefully, to ensure that, this RNC event doesn't cause an even bigger spike, not only here locally in Jacksonville, but across the state or the United States, because we know a lot of the RNC and DNC convention goers are not from the state that, it's being held in. So this could be a very risky event if not done well.
So what's your final advice then for people out there who are still really concerned about this virus, still trying to avoid catching it, and they're worried about how the state continues reopening just as the cases keep spiking again?
Yeah, so what we've been telling people, continually since March is really, you have to have some personal responsibility to ensure that although things might be opening up and the coast might be clear, and with that quarantine fatigue people might be feeling, the risk still is out there. People are still dying in the state of Florida from this that otherwise wouldn't if they didn't have COVID-19. So I think folks still have to maintain their awareness that they need to be social distancing, they need to be wearing their masks in public. I still think there's certainly a lot of, great things you can do in the midst of all this that, allow you to have a good summer, go to the beach and, do barbecues with family and things like that. I don't think, we need to tell people to limit all of that, but just do so in a safe manner. And I think I think we can do that here.
And we need to sort of stay the course, even though it's tough, isn't it? People are just so tired of this. But as you pointed out, this could be a very long haul.
Yeah, absolutely. And we especially don't want to get into the respiratory viral season in the fall with increased COVID burden on top of potentially increased influenza burden. So, flu vaccination campaigns typically start up in August and September. And so all of the hospital systems and the local public health departments are going to be, really encouraging flu vaccination this year, because hospitals are already filled in the fall and in the winter due to respiratory viruses. And this was without COVID-19 on the radar. And so now moving forward, we really need to see these COVID numbers come down across the state before we get into flu season. Otherwise, we could be facing a dire situation, as was predicted on the front end of this outbreak.
So again, everybody, listen to what Chad is saying. Keep wearing masks. Keep social distancing. Keep washing your hands. Keep avoiding large gatherings. Just use common sense, because cases are spiking. In fact, we're seeing record spikes of active COVID cases just over the last couple of days since the state has reopened. And I want to thank you, Chad, for being a semi-regular participant on this show with important health information.
Sure.
Thank you so much for joining us once again, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Melissa. Take care.
He's Chad Nielsen, a specialist with UF Health Jack's Division of Infectious Disease, talking about the latest COVID numbers. Up next, some good news. Why real estate is one sector of the local economy that's doing pretty well, even in this recession and pandemic. We'll tell you about it right after this.
As a student at Florida A&M University in the early 1960s, Cordell Petway peacefully protested for civil rights. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Cordell Petway. We'll discuss secret fraternal organizations in Florida and the impact of the 1928 hurricane. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Some of the worst COVID-19 outbreaks in the U.S. have occurred at long-term care facilities. Part of the problem? Staffers who don't know they're infected.
They're moving from room to room with close patient contact. Certainly if they're not wearing any mask at all, there's a good chance that they're shedding the virus.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The world's reporters and producers have a singular mission to put you in touch with events around the globe that affect life here in the U.S. From the coronavirus to global trade to efforts to dial back climate change, each day we bring you fresh insights, unique voices, one-of-a-kind reporting. Join us for an hour that takes you around the globe. It's right here. It's the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Jane has a 6-month-old baby. And like so many others, she and her partner have been juggling working from home with the demands of being a parent. How's that going?
We just don't think we can handle the pace of this much longer.
America's childcare crisis. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the economy continues to struggle in the COVID pandemic, but one surprisingly robust sector of that economy is residential real estate, and that's because of falling interest rates. With more, here's Eddie Cintrone of Watson Realty. Eddie, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me, Melissa.
Okay, so what is the housing market doing right now? I would think it might be stressed given all the other economic stressors, but you're seeing some movement, is that right?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
What are you looking at? What's the real estate picture right now?
Well, interestingly enough, actually moving forward quite nicely, pretty strong, I would say, all things considered, particularly with the pandemic having just passed us, or actually, frankly, still in it. We are seeing a relatively strong market.
And would you characterize it as a seller's market or a buyer's market?
Really good question. And frankly, we are in a bit of a, what I would say, unusual market and somewhat of a balanced market. And what I mean by that is we have a couple of key factors that we look at, one of them being the absorption rate. And when you look at an absorption rate, and basically all that means is the way that we look at the inventory that we have available to us to see if we have enough to satisfy the demand, the current demand. And when you look at that absorption rate, we should have about 6 months worth of inventory, but we have about 3 months worth of inventory, therefore making it a bit of a seller's market because that means that you have less competition. So if you have a home, this would be a great time to sell. Hmm. Also, home prices have gone up about 8% in the last 12 months. But at the same time, Melissa, we do have a bit of a buyer's market because we have historical low rates, making it just a perfect time for someone to purchase the home. And just to give you a way to kind of quantify this, if you take 1% difference in interest rate, say going from 4.5% to 3.5%, that would mean a difference of about $30,000 extra dollars in buying power for a buyer. That could mean the difference between qualifying them for their dream home or not.
Yeah, that's a big difference. Now, interest rates have really been lowered as a way to juice the economy. That is also working in residential real estate's favor. The rates are really attractive right now, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Extremely, extremely low.
What are most of your homes closing at? Like 3.5%, somewhere in that range?
Absolutely, and we're seeing some people even get under 3%, of course, for shorter terms, like a 15-year mortgage. Now, I am not a mortgage broker. I can't give you an exact number, but somewhere in the low 3 to maybe even under 3.
So how much confidence do you have about Jacksonville real estate? I mean, obviously, this is your business. You want to talk it up as much as you can. But given that the pandemic is still out there, there are still a lot of people out of work, you would think that would dampen the real estate market, but it doesn't sound like you're seeing that.
Yeah, you would think that it would, and certainly it did. There's a couple of months back in April being, I think, the rock bottom, we did see a decline. We saw a decline in loan applications and different things. But since then, we're seeing a huge uptick, I think 54% up in loans. So the buyers are out there. They're recognizing that it could be less expensive for them to actually buy than it is for them to rent. Rents are through the roof in the Jacksonville market, so it may make more sense, or it's making more sense to them to go ahead and buy because of the historic low rates.
Any other advice you have for buyers or sellers?
Absolutely. If you're a seller, I would say this is the time to go ahead and list your property. There'll be a lot less competition. I would say be prepared for a quick sale because of the demand. I would say be prepared for even having multiple offers. If you're a buyer, I would say there's less inventory, but that also means that you may not be able to negotiate as much on the price. So be prepared to have to pay list price, or be prepared to have to make strong offers if you're going against other offers, again, multiple offer situations. There's a lot of buyers out there, so there's more competition, but the low rates are making it really nice. And again, you can buy more property because of the low interest rates. And I would say the biggest thing for a buyer is to get themselves pre-qualified. Do not go shopping for the home that you want. The last thing you want is to fall in love with the home and then not be able to qualify. Or better yet, to fall in love with your dream home and then find out there's a multiple offer situation. And by the time you go back to get yourself pre-qualified, that property's already on the contract.
Good advice. He is Eddie Centrone, Watson Realty Corp. Vice President and Managing Broker. Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening, and to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo is 89.9's news director, and our digital editor is the very busy Bill Bortsfield. And you are always a big part of what we do. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Or our podcast is always online at wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back right here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Talk to you then, and hope your week is off to a good start.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.